Today, we're going to dive in the short-term rental space, how to finance them, and how physicians are able to invest with them in short-term rentals with significantly lower down payments and shelter up to six figures in clinical income from taxes. Joining us is Parker Borofsky. Parker is a master investor. She herself owns 12 short-term rentals and long-term rentals, producing over $1 million gross revenue. She is also an award-winning branch leader of Wealth Builders Mortgage Group under the National Lender Movement Mortgage. Movement Mortgage is dedicated to understanding the intricacies of real estate investment loans. She is also well-versed in navigating the mortgage process for complicated and for easy borrowers. Parker has closed over $1 billion in short-term rental loans and over 2,000 transactions in the last 5 years, and is dedicated to sharing her knowledge and her passion for teaching her clients as much as they want to learn.
Welcome to Generational Wealth MD's podcast on financial freedom through investing in real estate. My name is Param Baladandapani. I'm a mom, radiologist, real estate investor, and mentor to others looking to start or scale their real estate portfolios. The goal of this podcast is to provide you with inspiration, strategies, and insight so that you can stop trading your time for money and live life on your terms. If you love the episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review.
So welcome, Parker. Thank you for your time and thank you for educating us on this topic.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and share some great knowledge with everybody and hopefully give some out there a little more confidence in their investing journey.
Alrighty. So for someone new to real estate investing, Parker, what advice would you give them when it comes to securing financing?
It's a great question. So the very first thing I would say is, don't listen to anybody on Facebook. Stay away from lending advice from non-loan originators. I say that in jest. Sure, absolutely hear what people have to say, but make sure to speak with somebody who's qualified and really knows what they're doing, just because there's a lot of bad information. And I've had some panicked people come to me who were totally fine. So, because when it comes to calculating debt to income ratio and the different products and programs that are out there, everything's very specific to the borrower. Like, for example, I understand that you have different, I guess, hospital administrators that come in and take over payroll. Sometimes people get pushed to a 1099 versus W-2, you know, so there are products and programs to accommodate almost every situation. So advice on short-term rental lending would be, definitely speak to somebody who's qualified and versed. Not, you don't want to talk to just any lender though, because a lot of loan originators focus on primary homes and they may not be as well versed. You want to speak to a loan originator who does a lot of investment, second home, long-term, so forth.
And that's what I love about Parker, because she is an investor herself. So she kind of understands where we are coming from, and she deals with lots of physicians and high income earners. So she really knows, and her team really knows what they're doing. You know, when I started my real estate journey, I didn't know better. So I was going to lenders who were just, you know, primary home lenders. And they were like, okay, it's your third short term rental. You know, it's like they're, you know, like, just do what you need to do. So yeah, a lot of us are interested in knowing, you know, what is the difference between second home loans and then investment homes? So there are two different loan products, and how do they differ? What kind of things should we go to for that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. So one of the beautiful things with the short-term rental loans is a lot of times they're being purchased in areas people vacation, obviously. And so it can oftentimes fit into the box of being a second home loan. So it can be a second home and you can also rent it for amazing income. The benefit to the second home, at least conventional loan products. So this means a loan amount up to $766,000 in 95% of the country. You can do 10% down, which is awesome. And it's for preserving capital, to keep it for investing in other places. So that 10% down product is really nice. The 10% down jumbo isn't so fantastic these days. I'm hoping that comes back around as rates kind of settle down a little bit. We have a decent 15% down jumbo option, But if you're going jumbo, those bigger ones, the 20% down second home, of course, is still a great product as well. But yeah, so the second home, that 10% down, that's the biggest benefit conventionally. Mm-hmm. Now, investment occupancy is 15% down minimum. And that's, again, up to that loan amount of $766. And then the jumbo is 20%. But what's really neat about the investment occupancy is that we can use projected rental income. So if somebody's made a couple big real estate purchases and hasn't gotten the rental income filed yet on tax returns, then we can use projected rental income from the property to help offset the debt to income ratio. So it's an awesome tool to use in that scenario.
Right. So when you say the rental income can be used, does it have to be where you have had filed taxes for that property and you've shown that income, or can it just be projected income?
So if it's a property you already own, if it's a short-term rental, we do have to have at least one tax return reflecting that income. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a formula on that income. So a lot of times you're taking the big, like the cost seg deductions from it. And so the net may not look good on the taxes, but that's okay. Because when we do the calculation for that property, we're going to add back the expense lines. We'll add back taxes, insurance, mortgage interest, and all of that depreciation as we do our calculations. This is why I try to encourage people not to try to figure out their own debt to income ratio, because it's hard. Yeah, it's not easy. Right. Let us do the hard work for you. And then if it's a long-term rental, we can actually use a lease agreement. So if it's a long-term rental, we can use 75% of a lease agreement right away.
That's good to know. So there's that difference between the short-term rental and the long-term rental.
Correct.
Perfect. Also, while we're on this topic, a lot of people ask us that, can we own multiple homes with 10% down, or do we have a limit to that, or what's the criteria between one home that we own as 10% and then we're getting into a second deal? What does that look like?
Fantastic question. So in the same market, it doesn't typically make sense to have more than one second home. So for example, Smoky Mountains, mm-hmm. if you purchase one as a second home there, typically you wouldn't be able to purchase another, but you could at that point do investment occupancy, that 15% down product. Now, you could, though, go to another market. So say you went to a beach market or another area, you could then do another second home in a different market. It just has to make sense, basically.
Also, because when we do 10% or 15%, we do need to pay the PMI. Ah. And some people are in a, where they were trying to compare the 10% with PMI versus, paying 20% down. Obviously, with 10%, you also have to, maybe pay some points sometimes, to bring the interest rate down. So how do you look at that, that comparison with a PMI?
So what I tell people, I always encourage, if you have the capital and you don't really have anything else to do with it, I always encourage 20% down. Mm-hmm. But if you, if you have a certain amount of capital or you're trying to save and you have other places you'd like to invest that, so maybe your goal is to purchase, three properties this year, then I think it's an appropriate time to conserve the 10%. So if you can save 10% because you have plans for it, then the PMI is usually pretty minimal. And I think a lot of people are surprised when I tell them how much the PMI is. And again, whatever you do, don't use the Zillow PMI calculator. I don't know why, but it will really scare you. The PMI doesn't tend to be too bad. That being said, though, if you have nothing else you plan on doing with your capital, by all means, put 20% down.
Yeah, I've had it both ways. And like you said, I've had a PMI of maybe $50-$60 a month. So that's not too much. And where I can save that 10% and put it in another property, so it does make sense. Also, when we do a second home, sometimes lenders tell us, you have to stay in your home for like 14 days. There's always this question about, should I talk to my lender about transferring it to an LLC? Should I not even tell them? And some lenders are like, don't, they're like, if you do that, we're just going to call the loan. So it's kind of mixed reviews on that topic.
Yeah, absolutely. So the 14 days, so for Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac conventional loans, we're underwriting to those guidelines. There's no set amount of days in there. It actually just says some portion of the year. Right. And so that's where I go back to just common sense. You know, if by chance they ever looked that much into it or you got audited, you want to show that, hey, we did use this property a few times a year. It could be, you know, a couple weekends, maybe a week, but there's no defined number of days that's required. Mm-hmm. And it's only a 12-month occupancy agreement. So, you know, when you go into it, you really want your intention to be that, hey, yes, our family's going to use and enjoy this property. Now, beyond the 12 months, if things change and what have you not, it's okay. You're not going to mortgage jail.
That's right.
So you're good. And then in terms of the LLC, so this is also something I think a lot of loan originators just don't, maybe they don't know they can look up or they don't choose to look up, but it's actually in the servicing guidelines for Fannie Mae. It addresses the LLC. Mm-hmm. And basically those guidelines say if you transfer to an LLC, mm-hmm. as long as the person on the mortgage is majority owner or has control of that LLC, okay. It's totally fine.
If you're interested in learning how to invest in long-term and short-term rentals the right way, so you can accelerate to financial independence with the support of mentorship, community, and vetted investor agents in strong markets across the country, then get on the wait list for the next cohort of Creating Generational Freedom at www.generationalwealthmd.com. You don't have to learn from decades of costly mistakes by yourself. The program is only open for enrollment in the spring and fall each year. In the last 6 months alone, our members have acquired over $60 million of real estate, and more importantly, they are living life and practicing medicine on their terms. You don't have to do it alone.
That's great to know, because most lenders don't have an answer for that. We're just kind of trying to do that without telling a lender. And and then we're just nervous about calling the loan. So
right.
That answers that question. A lot of our members are looking into buying condos, especially in the Florida market. So could you explain what that means in terms of lending, where it's different from single family homes to condo tells? And we often hear, you know, warrantable condo, non-warrantable condo. So tell us more about condo lending for Florida.
Yeah, so that's a special topic.
Yes.
So there's a few things that go into it. So the first thing I would say is, I hope there's no realtors in here. No, I was kidding. I love realtors. They're great. But sometimes just be careful when you go into a condo. If the realtor tells you it's warrantable or not, they won't know because they're not lenders.
Right.
And this is crazy, but sometimes one lender may say something's not warrantable, but then another lender can get it approved.
Right.
It all has to do with interpretation of underwriting and guidelines for it to be warrantable. There's a few sticking points that nobody can get past, but basically what that means. So back in 2008, mm-hmm. when everything fell apart, and Fannie and Freddie were stuck with a bunch of mortgages, what happened was a lot of investors stopped paying their HOA dues. And then, so a big value piece of the condos is the exterior and the maintenance of the building. And so without HOA dues, they couldn't be maintained. And so the quality and value deteriorated quite a bit. So because of that, there are several different checkboxes that have to be met for Fannie and Freddie to deem the HOA as stable, we could say, or, you know, up to their standards. And then also if you're doing an investment occupancy loan, they won't allow it. It's not warrantable if there's greater than 50% concentration of investors in that HOA. But if it's a second home or primary home, that doesn't apply. So that's why it gets a little tricky. So on those, it's hard to tell up front if they're going to be warrantable or not. So part of the process is just, you know, having the lender get those docs pretty quickly right. and get him to the team and see what comes of that. So I will say that we have an amazing condo team at Movement. And so we've gotten quite a few, you know, it's been pretty rare that we've not been able to qualify a condo. We do have a couple non-warrantable products mm-hmm. as well. So if it comes back as non-warrantable, I think it's 20% down on our second home, but the rates aren't actually that much different
okay.
than conventional. Okay. So yeah, so when it comes to condo lending, it does get a little more touchy in mm-hmm. terms of qualifying, but it can definitely be done. So don't be scared.
So we should, if we are getting into a condo, we should get you the HOA documents sooner than later. For the you to assess what kind of loan product would be best.
Great. But
can you still do 15% down though, or 10% down?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We can, absolutely. Yeah, as long as it's warrantable, we can. And you don't have to get the docs, just get us the HOA contact info and then we'll do all the legwork. So you don't even have to worry about that. Yeah.
It's awesome that you have a team for that.
We do.
Our life much easier.
Yes. Awesome. It's like, can you stop saving lives and go find some condo docs for us? Yes.
I know, right? I'm like, I bought a condo in the earlier part of my investing, and it was a nightmare to get everything lined up for the lender, you know?
Right.
So, but it's doing well, so it was worth it.
Good.
Yeah. All righty. So, we have a lot of questions about interest rates. I know interest rates play a crucial role in our mortgage market. And recently we've seen, you know, that the interest rates are pretty high. So any advice on that, you know, on interest rates? I know you have like no crystal ball there, but what are you looking at? What is your, you know, foreseeable future looks like for interest rates?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one myth is that rates will come down when the Fed drops, mm-hmm. But rates are actually not directly, well, mortgage rates are not directly tied to the Fed. They influence them, but they're not directly tied. So they've actually dropped a lot already since October. They were ugly. Like primary homes were at 8%. Now we're down to about 7.25%. And they had dipped down last month to about 6.75. This is primary home rate, just to give you a better idea. It's easier to explain those.
Right.
And now they're at 7.25. So they've come up a little bit just because recently we've had the inflation data where it's not coming down. It's being a little stubborn. So people are kind of pumping the brakes a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think naturally my crystal ball, I would guess, yeah, I think they'll probably hold steady for a while. And then I hope they'll start to trickle down again as soon as we start seeing some of that inflation numbers. And it doesn't have to be, we don't have to wait until the Fed cut comes. You know, as things start to improve, they'll go down. Now, conversely, though, if inflation doesn't improve or it starts to get worse, they could also creep back up. And so that's kind of where we are now. And I don't predict a refinance opportunity for another probably 18 to 24 months, because even when they start to come down, you're going to want to give them some time to really come down to a certain level before doing the refinance.
Right. That's great advice. So for some of those, some of us who may be unfamiliar, could you explain what debt-to-income ratio means and then how that matters to the mortgage process? And then what do you look at as a lender? What is the requirement for your DTI?
Absolutely. So so we'll look at your gross monthly income, and we can do it. And, you know, if you're married, we can do it with just one spouse, see if they qualify. I always recommend to go that route first, or use both if necessary. And so we'll look at that gross monthly income versus the monthly obligations. And then in terms of that gross monthly income, so we do not look at AGI on our tax returns. I have a lot of clients who are really concerned or afraid to even reach out to a lender because, let's say, one of them has a strong income, but the other, maybe they started a business that took a huge loss. And so they think, oh, my AGI, my adjusted gross income on my taxes was low, so I can't qualify. I want you to know that if a spouse took a big loss, or if you have big write-offs on your properties, none of that plays into your qualifying. So if you're a W-2 employee, we're going to look at your gross W-2 income and use that. If you're self-employed, we're going to do, there's a formula on self-employment that we'll take and apply that number. And so we look at everything individually, property income, W-2, self-employment, it's all separate. And so it's a little bit of an intricate process, which is why I don't fear AI can take over our job anytime soon.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So what is that cutoff? What number are you looking at? Is it 50% debt to income ratio? What is that good cutoff that we want to stay within?
So for a conventional loan, typically it's going to be 50%.
Okay.
If you're in that jumbo realm, typically 43 to 45% in the jumbo world. Mm-hmm. And then we also have bank statement loans. So if, you know, you opened a new practice or something and you have a year history of that, we can look at bank statements and qualify based on an average of deposits. Mm-hmm. And then there is also, and I didn't used to be a big fan of this, I like it better now when necessary, but there's the debt service coverage ratio loan.
Yes, yeah, that was on my question list, but yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, jump yeah. ahead.
That's great to talk about that now. Yeah.
So, you know, it's become a better product. So we actually have a really strong DSCR product. There's no prepayment penalty. It's a 30-year fixed. And the rates recently are actually pretty comparable to conventional. I mean, maybe ever so slightly higher. So that product is a great option as well when needed. I would still recommend going conventional first if you could, just because the terms are a little bit better. But that debt service coverage ratio, and that's where, for those of you who don't know, that's where we look at the projected income of the property versus the payment. And we can use AirDNA data for that. We could use a 12-month history if the property has a 12-month history. Or we could use an appraiser. We can have an appraiser do a fair market rent valuation as well. So we can use that data to determine that for the DSCR, and debt to income ratio doesn't matter. It's just the property ratio. That one.
Right, right. Would you recommend that once the conventional loans, you're saturated with your personal conventional loans, then to go there, or should we still look at it even before that?
No, I think, I mean, if it were me personally, I would max out my conventional loans before doing that.
Okay.
Again, just because the terms are a little bit higher. And if you don't need it, then conventional is just a stronger product, in my opinion.
Sure. That's great. That's great. Mm-hmm. So some of us have questions about, you know, working with local in-state lenders versus national lenders when we're securing a mortgage. Somehow we feel like if it's in the same state, we will get some, you know, they may know the area better. Is that, does that really make a difference? What would you advise our listeners for that?
Well, I'm a little biased.
Yeah.
I think it depends on who you're working with. So there's a couple of us loan originators that really focus on short-term rentals. So for example, I'm licensed in 39 states, and I do just fine in all of those states. But this is kind of where it goes back to, depends on who you're working with in state. So if you're working with a really strong loan originator who understands, you know, like, please don't call Rocket Mortgage. You're going to get somebody who probably doesn't know what they're doing. Maybe they do, but probably not as in-depth as you may need. I think it depends on the loan originator more so than the lender themselves. And the appraisers, they're part of a network anyway that all lenders in the area are pulling from. So these aren't appraisers that are employed by the lender. They're all independent contractors. They contract with appraisal management companies or AMCs. And then all the lenders use these AMCs. So there's not necessarily an appraisal benefit there either. So it depends on who your national person is versus that market.
Yeah. I have the same opinion. I would rather go with somebody who's more of an expert in what they're doing rather than where they are located. You know, it really doesn't matter. So that's excellent. Before we wrap up, any final tips to our listeners, particularly with short-term rentals, and then how can we reach you for our mortgage questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would really just encourage, I think it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like when I need to do my taxes, I dread doing my taxes and getting all the documents together and setting up the meeting. And then it just sits in the back of my mind forever. So I'm sure that's the case also with a lot of people and lending.
Right.
Because it's like, oh, we've got to get all this info together before we have the conversation, see what we're qualified for. So I understand that. But depending on where you are in your journey and, you know, how ready you are to be able to start looking, I really encourage you to set up that call, get that info to help you, you know, to help you kind of navigate where you're going, to understand your numbers, what you qualify for, and to help you build out an initial game plan. You know, just like anything that can sometimes be tough, I think people procrastinate that. I know I would. I also know that nothing gets you to get your taxes done faster than a property you want to purchase.
Right. Yeah.
So I definitely would encourage you guys, if any of you just kind of want to have a consultation, I'm happy. My team's happy. We can kind of walk through and see where your numbers are. I'm happy to also share with you, because I lend in a lot of different markets, happy to share with you some insight on some of those markets that I see from a lending perspective as well. So yeah. And then, so I have a new website. So our group is called Wealth Builders Mortgage Group. It's part of, I work for Movement Mortgage. They're a national lender. But I branded our group because we specialize and focus on investors and short-term rentals. And so we have wealthbuildersmortgage.com. And on there, you can set up a Calendly or submit an inquiry on our website, and we'll get back with you. And as far as loan originators go, it's myself, and I have a senior loan originator, Rob, who's also excellent. And then we have a team behind us. Once you're under contract, the team steps in and helps coordinate and get your loan from start to finish. So
that's great. I can attest to your team. It's excellent. So thank you so much again, Parker.
I hope you've been inspired by this episode and are ready to take action. Your feedback means the world to me. If you found value in what you heard, I would greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate the podcast, leave a review, and follow the podcast. And if you really like the episode, share it with a friend. Your ratings, reviews, follows, and shares not only motivate me, but they also help others discover the show and join the community. So please share your thoughts. Let me know what you liked and even what you'd like to hear more of in the future. I can't wait to hear from you. Stay tuned for more exciting episodes. And until next time, take care.